FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Welcome. You are listening to the Financial Survival Network. I'm here with John Rubino late afternoon on May 11th, and you'll be hearing this on May 12th. I'm Kerry Lutz. Well, we're looking at a market. We're looking at a world economy. Well, as John would put it, just another bricks in the wall. And John, well, first though, email us with your thoughts. Where do you think the global economy is at now? Where is it going? And how long is it going to take us to get there? John Rubino with us now. Don't forget, go over to dollarcollapse.com. Make sure you sign up for John's free newsletter. John, happy Monday. And wow, like we've got some major things that are totally not in the mainstream media's wheelhouse, to say the least.
Hey, Kerry. Yeah, well, there's no one big story right now that that says, oh, my God, the world is ending. But there are a lot of, like you said, bricks in the wall of the story that the system is in a lot more danger than even we tend to think that it is. So I'll go through a few of them. One of the most interesting ones is China, because remember the New Silk Road Initiative?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the belt.
Was going around the world lending money to developing countries so they could build roads and bridges and airports and basically, with the idea of trying to create trade lanes that China could dominate in the coming century. Well, a lot of those loans are going bad, if not all of them, because, the emerging markets right now are, if anything, harder hit than the developing world by the coronavirus, because we're not buying their stuff anymore. And especially in the case of oil, if you're a natural resource exporting country, the price of everything that you were selling is way down, and your loans, especially if they're denominated in dollars, are getting harder and harder to cover. So China is stuck with a lot of non-performing debt out there, on top of all the domestic non-performing debt they got. So they're looking at a financial crisis of some sort, depending on how they handle this. Do they just go in and repossess most of the developing world? Which is kind of what the U.S. has done for a really long time. We had this economic hitman thing going where we would go in and lend money to a Latin American country or an Asian country, on the assumption that they would never be able to pay it back. And then when they couldn't pay it back, we could come in and dictate their behavior.
Their gunboat diplomacy.
Yeah. Well, financial diplomacy. Mm-hmm. Financial gunboat diplomacy, yeah. But there's a book called Confessions of an Economic Hitman, where one of the guys mm-hmm. whose job it was to do this stuff told the story of how it works. And so China was kind of sort of doing something like that, where they would have been okay if these countries couldn't repay their debts and China would have to come in and gain influence in one way or another. But now the whole world is watching this, so it's not clear what they're going to do. Maybe they just have to eat these loans, makes the financial crisis just that much worse. So that's one thing, one issue that's sort of under the surface, but is potentially front page news. And then, and by the way, one of the themes of this could be, and this is why we call the dollar the best looking horse at the glue factory, right?
Yeah, the Taj Mahal of Baltimore.
Yeah. And so if we go over to Europe, there is now a battle going on between the German Central Bank and the European Court of Justice over who gets to decide how much QE is too much. And the German Central Bank said, the German court has said that the European Central Bank has overstepped its bounds and is doing too much QE. In other words, buying too many assets with too much newly created currency, and in that way threatening the viability of the euro. And, Germany is especially worried about this because they've had a hyperinflation within almost living memory. So they're really touchy about anything that messes with the long-term value of their currency. So you've got this battle going on. And the reason that there is a battle is because Europe is only halfway through its integration process. They intend at some point down the road to become like the U.S., where there's one central government And where France and Germany and Italy are kind of like California and New York, you know, they're entities who have some control over their domestic affairs within a broader system where there's a central government that is really the boss. Okay. But we're nowhere near that yet. And so there can still be these battles. And that's why the euro is a weak currency, because there's no guarantee that the eurozone and or the EU stays together with all these battles, because it's not clear that there's any way that Germany and Italy and Spain and Portugal and France are all going to be able to agree on a common monetary policy and a common integration strategy. So the euro is not really what you would call a reserve currency, because you don't know what it's going to be like 5 years from now, or if it will even exist a decade from now. So that's out there and it's bubbling and we don't know how it's going to play out. Meanwhile, in the U.S., the GDP Now report, which is a kind of a real-time GDP measure put out by the Atlanta Fed, is now calling for negative 34.9% for the second quarter.
Oh my
that's
God.
The rate at which the economy will be contracting. So that's the number we've
been. That's second quarter, John? Second quarter. Wow.
Yeah. In other words, the current quarter, what we're in right now, is going to come in at negative 34.9%. We didn't even see that during the Great Depression. So this is, you know, incredibly serious and incredibly fast what has happened here. Another example of how fast and how crazy things have gotten is California's deficit. They were in surplus 4 months ago. And now they're talking about potentially a $100 billion deficit for the current fiscal year. Which means that, you know, they're a heavily indebted state with grossly underfunded pension liabilities. And, you know, it's not clear how they manage their indebtedness if they're having to borrow another $100 billion this year. So that means that the states are going to demand ever bigger bailouts from the federal government. You know, this will be one of those things where it doesn't happen all at once, where, you know, Washington is dragged kicking and screaming into a full-on bailout of all the pension funds in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And I think now, there's no doubt that they're going to have to do it. But the question is, can they hang on till after the election and then blame it on the Democrats? Or do they have to do it now and be complicit in bailing out all these badly managed pension funds? And who knows? with more GDP numbers like negative 34%, it's not clear they've got much time to dither here.
Right.
Now, one other really interesting story is the Swiss National Bank, which illustrates what central banks are going to become, because they're leading the way in buying equities. You know, they don't even hide it, or they don't have any euphemisms for it or anything. They just are running a hedge fund now in Switzerland, in which their national bank, their central bank, is buying large amounts of global tech stocks. Basically, that's their favorite, you know, Apple and Google and things like that. And they got creamed when the stock market tanked a few weeks ago. Or was it a few months ago now? It seems like it was pretty recently, but they lost a lot of money. But instead of learning their lesson that they shouldn't be in risky assets, they doubled down. They created a whole bunch of new Swiss francs and bought a lot of new tech stocks. And it worked for them. They made back most of their losses. And they look smart. They look like a smart hedge fund. So the other central banks of the world are looking at the Swiss central bank now and thinking, wow, you know, we could do that. We could create unlimited amounts of new money and buy tech stocks and push the tech stocks up by doing that, and make our positions more and more profitable. You know, it's like the perfect perpetual motion machine, and we could do that too. So, watch for other central banks if you want to emulate the Swiss National Bank.
That's great. You gotta love it. You gotta love it. I mean, when you think of all the things the central bank was purportedly created to do, becoming a hedge fund, buying and selling shares to profit. And obviously, they have the best insider information in the world, and they can still lose money at it because their purpose isn't really to make money. It's just to maintain some type of market equilibrium. This is completely a travesty, isn't it?
see, at least in theory, they won't be able to lose when everybody else is doing it together, right? If you've got the Fed and the ECB and the Bank of Japan all buying stocks with newly created money, then how can stocks ever go down? The central banks don't have to allow them to go down because they can create as much new currency as it takes to buy those stocks when other people are selling them. So we're talking about basically a leveraged buyout of the private sector by the public sector. And without it being called that, it's just central banks trying to stabilize the value of their currencies. But what it really is, once they get going, I mean, once they figure out that it's a no-lose proposition buying equities because they can support the prices of what they're buying by creating, yes. You know, then we are in totally uncharted territory here.
Oh, it's amazing. Certainly are that.
This is okay.
It's mind-boggling here. The implications here, because you know that eventually the government will lose, because that is their job. Harry Brown, the famous economist from the 70s and 80s, called government the accommodating loser. And that's their role, whether they're buying gold, whether they're buying stocks, whether they're buying foreign currency to stabilize markets. Their purpose is to lose and be happy losing, because all the other participants are in it to win it, but not the central banks.
That was back when there was some theoretical limit on central bank easing.
Yeah.
And people were actually watching the money supply, you know,
mm-hmm. And velocity and stuff like that. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, back, I worked at a German bank in New York City back in the 1980s, and the biggest indicator for us back then was the money supply. It would come out once a week and everybody would be watching it, and because it mattered. We thought it mattered.
It did then.
And now it means nothing. You know, nobody knows what M2 is doing anymore or cares. And because of that, or that's why central banks are basically free to operate as they see fit. So, you know, they might not be the accommodating losers anymore. They might be the whale in the market that gets to push everybody else around and move prices wherever they want them to move. And as long as they own huge portfolios of stocks, they're never going to want prices to go down. So I don't know, Kerry, this is one of those things you can't make this up. Like no science fiction book could have anything like this in it, because people would say, oh, that's just too unrealistic. I can't suspend disbelief in order to follow your story, because it could never happen, but it's happening. So we're gonna get to watch it happen. One other story that is interesting and along these same lines now is Germany's lockdown.
Yes,
they everybody thought they did a great job of flattening the curve. In other words, lowering the new instances of coronavirus to the point where they thought they could open up again, and they did. They opened up in a limited way, but then new cases spiked. So it's not clear whether, you know, opening works or whether they did it wrong. And then, as you were saying before we went live, was it Georgia?
Yeah, Georgia. Georgia reopened against universal condemnation and criticism from Trump 16 days ago, and they've seen their cases go down. And look, I said from the get-go, it's been a theory that I've embraced, is that as things heat up, literally the temperature, summer, spring turns into summer, that viruses don't thrive in that environment, and you would see a decline. And sure enough, we're seeing it really across the country. You can't go by number of people tested positive, because there's a simple reason for that. They're doing way more testing. They're testing 300,000 people a day in the U.S., so, of course, they're going to be finding a lot more cases, but hospitalizations are down across the country and deaths are starting to decline. And those can be the result of people infected as long as 2 weeks ago. So I'm not saying happy days are here again. I'm just saying it was never going to be as bad as they claimed it was going to be.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next.
Lumina Gold, ticker symbol LUM on the Toronto Venture and LMGDF on the OTC, is yet another of legendary mining investor Ross Beaty's Lumina Group. It's advancing the largest primary gold deposit in Ecuador. The resource is estimated to contain 16.7 million ounces of gold and 2.2 billion pounds of copper. At just $7 US per ounce gold equivalent, it trades at an incredible 13% of its net present value. More good news is on the way with an updated PEA study expected in Q2 of 2020. It has unparalleled infrastructure. There's grid power to camp with plentiful, inexpensive hydropower available. It's close to two ports and is just 8 kilometers from a paved highway. Water is plentiful. It's at low elevation, and the closest community, which is very supportive of Lumina's effort, is just a 7-kilometer ride. With all this going for it, it's likely to follow the typical Ross Beaty formula, which means big returns to shareholders. Find out more and sign up for notifications at luminagold.com. That's Lumina, L-U-M-I-N-A, gold.com.
The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Well, that would be great because, you know, for us, it's an annoyance. But for a lot of other people, it's life-threatening. Not the virus itself, but the lockdown, because the government in the U.S. started well with the way it was handling, you know, managing the crisis when it gave everybody a little bit of money right up front.
Mm-hmm.
And then it switched gears.
It's a hyperdrive.
Bailing out.
Everyone in sight.
Yeah, but that money's not going directly to the people who might not be able to feed their kids, because, you know, you get laid off from your job, mm-hmm. and the government gives you $1,200 and it maybe covers rent, but you still got to buy food. You know, your medical care isn't free, and mm-hmm. you've got to do all the other things you've got to do to keep your family alive. And mm-hmm. there's no money coming in. You might be getting unemployment benefits, but you might not be, depending on your job. You know, if you're a gig worker or self-employed, something like that, you might literally not be getting any more money besides that $1,200.
It's hard to get it because you got to prove lost income. I've already checked it out in Florida, and what they'll deny your claim, but then you put in a supplemental application, and they want to know exactly how you were doing it. They want to see bank account statements. They want to see a license if you're a licensed company. They want to see invoices from people you're doing contracting from, signed by the customer. And you know what a pain that is to do, to get a customer to sign an invoice.
And that's if you can get the bank on the phone the government on the phone, you know, which sounds like...
No, you can't.
It's helpful, you know?
Well, I'll confess that they were kind enough to send me some helicopter money. And I took the money because... I might need it in the future. I might not need it right this instant, but you never know. And B, I'm already paying for this money in terms of a decreased and depressed purchasing power on my once hard-earned dollars. So I've already paid for the stimulus. I might as well get it all. And I'm legally entitled to it, or otherwise I wouldn't attempt to get it. And, you know, it's become a free-for-all here. And it's free money. And when you have free money, it brings out the worst vile instincts in people, myself included. And what it's going to do, though, is probably jumpstart this economy initially and then lead to an outrageous disaster down the road. John, can it work any other way?
Well, let's say that the second quarter is basically the end of the recession. And mm-hmm. we get growth in the third and fourth quarters. And, you know, things go back to, you know, quote unquote,
normalize. Normalize.
Except that we'll have, what, $10 trillion of new debt on top of all the debt we had. You know, we're going to increase the federal deficit by like $4 trillion this year, in 1 year, you know.
We're going to prove out MMT, right? This is the Petri dish of MMT. What we're going through now, modern monetary theory.
Yeah, and what that means is, I mean, we already knew this, that you could never raise interest rates again. But now that is doubly true, because try raising interest rates on, you know, the rollover amount of $25 trillion mm-hmm. each year. is going to be considerable, you know, and that means your interest costs ratchet up until they bankrupt you. If you're the U.S. or Japan or most countries in Europe, you know, we can never raise interest rates again.
How do you ever recover from this?
Yeah, well, it just means the currencies are doomed because we no longer have the tool of higher interest rates to stop the decline in the value of one of the major currencies out there, right? I mean, that's what we did in the 1970s. Our last currency crisis was in the 1970s when inflation was double digits in the U.S. and the dollar was plunging and everybody was wondering if it could even survive. They had to raise interest rates to 20%.
I know.
In order to stop that crisis. And that worked back then because we were actually in pretty good financial shape. You know, we were not that indebted in the late 1970s.
Not like now.
Yeah, and now, you know, you raise interest rates. Let's say you raise the 10-year treasury from 0.6% where it is today to 4%, which is historically on the low side. The system blows up.
I know.
The world is over.
Just to sum this up here, John, where we're at, because we've talked about the Silk Road and Belt Initiative, that's gone bust. The battle between the ECB and the German central bank, they can't agree. They're not disagreeing on the approach, just how much QE is a good thing. And the German Supreme Court has ruled that the ECB has gone too far with QE. And Europe is only halfway through its integration process, and they're probably not going to get any further, especially after Brexit. And then second quarter GDP down a whopping negative, it's down 34.9% in the U.S., California deficit, $100 billion, and pension funds are just ready to bust. Big bailouts demanded by the states. And then my favorite one is the Swiss National Bank is now a hedge fund, and they lost money on the decline, but they made it back. And they become the role model, John, for all the world's central banks who make any kind of currency at all, right?
Well, see, a lot of these guys suspect that their electronic printing presses are a perpetual motion machine. In other words, they can create as much new money as they want to, and then the economy grows, and then they create some more new money with no consequence. That's what modern monetary theory says. And that's what a lot of Keynesianism, you know, suspects, but they were never willing to say it. You know, it's like how the Democrats could never say the S word. They could never say socialist because that was the kiss of death. And then they figured out they could and it was okay. Now, the central bankers of the world are starting to suspect that they can get away with this forever. And that's sort of that's the end of a binge, right? When you're doing something and you have some self-control because you know it's wrong, you do it, you get away with it and you keep getting away with it. And then you realize, you know, there's nobody stopping you. You can do this forever. Yeah. And then you're doomed because you're doing it until something stops you because there is a limit.
But then you black out. And you started in L.A. on Sunday and you woke up in Paris on the following Friday and you don't remember anything in between, but it must have been good.
So that's how it's working monetarily now. It started in Japan and Switzerland, and then it moved to
It's a cancer.
U.S. and then everybody blacked out. You know, that's the time currency is coming is when everything short circuits, and it just no longer works anymore. Like if you're trying to call the Small Business Administration to get your SBA loan, and they won't answer the phone. So that's what this is going to be like. Writ large, right? It's everybody going to their central banks and saying, save us.
And it's worse.
Won't answer the phone. Yeah.
It's worse than that, John. Yeah. Or you're in Florida and you're calling the unemployment office to get your unemployment money because you're going to food banks that are lined up around the corner because the average person had $400 worth of savings. Didn't even have $400. But fortunately, you can count on the banks to cut your credit line, cut your credit card exactly when you need it the most. There was a quote from Mark Twain that somebody sent me today that the banker is like a person that gives you an umbrella when it's sunny outside, and then when it starts raining, they take it back. And this is a perfect example of them doing that. And finally, Germany and Georgia two contrasts in reopening. Georgia reopens 2 weeks ago. You can go get a haircut, a massage, go out for dinner, and get a tattoo. Maybe in that order as well. And their rate of cases, new cases, and hospitalizations. Most statistics here aren't the number of cases, it's the number of hospitalizations, particularly ICU, people on ventilators, and it's the number of deaths. And in both categories, they're going down. Whereas Germany tries to reopen and they've had a spike in hospitalizations and deaths, which really throws into question the whole world reopening. China's reopened, but they got nobody to buy their stuff. So what good is it?
Yeah. And in other words, there's a lot of stuff going on out there, all of which is
bad. Oh, bad.
and a lot of which is being lost in the shuffle here, because there's so much to worry about. A lot of these stories, I mean, if you've got a 30-minute news show, right? Mm-hmm. And you're trying to cover all of this, you get through maybe the first two, and then your 30 minutes are up. So a lot of this stuff people aren't even hearing about yet, but all of it is pretty scary. And then...
Well, you have a 30-minute news show, and on mainstream TV, even if it's Fox News, they're not going to cover any of this stuff other than to say more people are dying and more people are going to, get COVID-19 and the world's going to end. That's the main story on the mainstream media. But anyway, since we're confined to only about 30 minutes ourselves, at least we told you what needed to be told. And you can look at this thing with a different perspective. You want to find out more, go over to John's site, dollarcollapse.com. Make sure you sign up for his newsletter. John's writing is prolific and a very high caliber. And check out our site, financialsurvivalnetwork.com. Our newsletter, Twitter feed's at Kerry Lutz. Facebook page, I don't know why I even say it, is Financial Survival Network. And John, we will pick up where we left off next Monday.
Great, Kerry. Till then.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.